about the end of the world and the possibility of hell forever. You living there, still a boy, unable to die or leave or do anything but burn in a lake of fire. Sadness came when you had to wake up your snoring dad in church. Even as members of the congregation, members of your family, were being slain by the Holy Ghost in the aisles right next to him. Sadness came when the days got shorter at the end of summer, when the street got quiet without kids out anymore. In the color of that fleeting sky, sadness lurked. Sadness pounced, slid in between everything, anything it could find its way into, through sound, through you. You didn't think of any of the tapping or knocking as drumming until you actually started drumming many years later. It would have been good to know that you'd always done something naturally. But there was too much going on with everyone else in your family for anyone to notice you should probably have done something else with your fingers and toes than tap. With your mind and time, then knock at all the surfaces in your life like you were looking for a way in. You're headed to a powwow. You were invited to drum at the Big Oakland Powwow, even though you'd quit drum classes. You weren't going to go. You didn't want to see anyone from work since you got fired, especially anyone from the powwow committee. But there's never been anything like it for you. The way that big drum fills your body to where there's only the drum, the sound, the song. The name of your drum group is Southern Moon. You joined a year after you first started working at the Indian Center as a janitor. You're supposed to say custodian now, or maintenance person, but you've always thought of yourself as a janitor. When you were 16, you went on a trip to Washington, D.C., to visit your uncle, your mom's brother. He took you to the American Art Museum, where you discovered James Hampton. He was an artist, a Christian, a mystic, a janitor. James Hampton would end up meaning everything to you. Anyway, being a janitor was just a job. It paid the rent, and you could have your earphones in all day. No one wants to talk to the guy cleaning up. The earphones are an additional service. People don't have to pretend to be interested in you because they feel bad that you're taking their trash out from under their desk and giving them a fresh bag. Drum group was Tuesday nights. All were welcome. Not women, though. They had their own drum group Thursday nights. They were Northern Moon. You first heard the big drum by accident one night after work. You'd come back because you'd forgotten your earphones. You were just about to get on the bus when you realized they weren't in your ears when you most wanted them, for that long ride home after work. The drum group played on the first floor, in the community center. You walked into the room and, just as you did, they started singing. High-voiced wailing and howled harmonies that screamed through the boom of that big drum. Old songs that sang to the old sadness you always kept as close as skin without meaning to. The word triumph blipped in your head then. What was it doing there? You never used that word. This was what it sounded like to make it through these hundreds of American years. To sing through them. This was the sound of pain forgetting itself in song. You went back every Tuesday for the next year. Keeping time wasn't hard for you. The hard part was singing. You'd never been a talker. You'd certainly never sung before. Not even alone. But Bobby made you do it. Bobby was big, maybe 6'4", 350. He said he was big because he came from 8 different tribes. He had to fit all of them in there, he said, pointing at his stomach. He had the best voice in the group, hands down. He could go high or low. And he was the one who first invited you in. If it was up to Bobby, the drum would be bigger, would include everyone. He'd have the whole world on a drum if he could. Bobby Big Medicine. Sometimes a name just fit right. Your voice is low like your dad's. You can't even hear it when I sing, you told Bobby after class one day. So what? Dad's body. Bass harmony is underappreciated, Bobby told you, then handed you a cup of coffee. The big drum's all you need for bass, you said. Voice bass is different than drum bass, Bobby said. Drum bass is closed. Voice bass opens. I don't know, you said. Voice can take a long time to come all the way out, brother, Bobby said. Be patient. You walk outside your studio apartment to a hot Oakland summer day. An Oakland you remember is gray. Always gray. Oakland summer days from your childhood. Mornings so gray they filled the whole day with gloom and cool even when the blue broke through. This heat's too much. You sweat easy. Sweat from walking. Sweat at the thought of sweating. Sweat through clothes to where it shows. You take off your hat and squint up at the sun. At this point, you should probably accept the reality of global warming, of climate change. The ozone thinning again, like they said in the 90s, when your sisters used to bomb their hair with Aquanet, and you'd gag and spit in the sink extra loud to let them know you hated it, and to remind them about the ozone. How hairspray was the reason the world might burn, like it said in Revelation. The next end. The second end after the flood. A flood of fire from the sky this time. Maybe from the lack of ozone protection. Maybe because of their abuse of Aquanet. And why did they need their hair 3 inches in the air, curled over like a breaking wave? Because what? You never knew. Except that all the other girls did it too. And hadn't you also heard or read that the world tilts on its axis ever so slightly every year, so that the angle made the earth like a piece of metal when the sun hits it just right, and it becomes just as bright as the sun itself? Hadn't you heard that it was getting hotter because of this tilt? This ever-increasing tilt of the earth? Which was inevitable and not humanity's fault. Not our cars, or emissions, or Aquanet, but plain and simple entropy? Or was it atrophy? Or was it apathy? You're near downtown, headed for the 19th Street BART station. You walk with a slightly dropped, sunken right shoulder, just like your dad's. The limp too, right side. You knew this limp could be mistaken for some kind of affect. Some lame attempt at gangsta lean. But on some level that you maybe didn't even acknowledge, you knew that walking the way you walk is a way of subverting the straight-postured, upright, citizenly way of moving one's arms and feet just so. To express obedience. To pledge allegiance to a way of life and to a nation and its laws. Left, right, left, and so on. But had you really cultivated this lean, this drop-shouldered walk, this way of swaying slightly to the right in opposition? Is it really some native-specific counter-cultural thing you're going for? Some vaguely anti-American movement? Or do you only walk the way your dad walked because genes and pain and styles of walking and talking get passed down without anyone even trying? The limp is something you've cultivated to look more like a statement of your individual style, and less like an old basketball injury. To get injured and not recover is a sign of weakness. Your limp is practiced, an articulate limp, which says something about the way you've learned to roll with the punches, all the ways you've been fucked over, knocked down, what you've recovered from or haven't, that you've walked or limped away from with or without style. That's on you. You pass a coffee shop you hate because it's always hot and flies constantly swarm the front of the shop, where a big patch of sun seethes with some invisible shit the flies love, and where there's always just that one seat left in the heat with the flies, which is why you hate it. On top of the fact that it doesn't open until 10 in the morning and closes at 6 in the evening to cater to all the hipsters and artists who hover and buzz around Oakland like flies. America's white suburban vanilla youth, searching for some invisible thing Oakland might give them. Street cred or inner city inspiration. Before getting to the 19th Street station, you pass a group of white teenagers who size you up. You're almost afraid of them. Not because you think they'll do anything. It's how out of place they are, all the while looking like they own the place. You want to run them down, scream something at them, scare them back to wherever they came from. Scare them out of Oakland. Scare the Oakland they made their own out of them. You could do it, too. You're one of those big lumbering Indians. 6 feet, 230, chip on your shoulders so heavy it makes you lean. Makes everyone look at it. Your weight, what you carry. Your dad is 1,000% Indian. An overachiever. A recovering alcoholic medicine man from the res for whom English is a second language. He loves to gamble and smoke American Spirit cigarettes, has false teeth, and prays for 20 minutes before every meal. Asks for help from the Creator for everyone, beginning with the orphan children and ending with the servicemen and servicewomen out there. Your 1,000% Indian dad who only cries in ceremony and has bad knees that took a turn for the worse when he laid concrete in your backyard for a basketball court when you were 10. You know your dad could once play ball. Knew the rhythm of the bounce, the head fake and eye swivel. Pivot shit you learned how to do by putting in time. Sure, he leaned heavily on shots off the glass, but that was the way it used to be done. Your dad told you he hadn't been allowed to play ball in college because he was Indian in Oklahoma. Back in 1963, that was all it took. No Indians or dogs allowed on courts or in bars or off the reservation. Your dad hardly ever talked about any of it, being Indian or growing up on the res, or even what he felt like now that he's a certifiable urban Indian. Except sometimes, when he felt like it, out of nowhere. You'd be riding in his red Ford truck to Blockbuster to rent a movie. You'd be listening to your dad's peyote tapes. The tape's staticky gourd rattle and kettle drum boom. He liked to play it loud. You couldn't stand how noticeable the sound was, how noticeably Indian your dad was. You'd ask if you could turn it off. You'd make him turn off his tapes. You'd put on 106 KMEL, rap or R&B. But then he'd try to dance to that. He'd stick his big Indian lips out to embarrass you, stick one flat hand out and stab at the air in rhythm to the beat just to mess with you. That's when you'd turn the music off altogether. And that was when you might hear a story from your dad about his childhood, about how he used to pick cotton with his grandparents for a dime a day, or the time an owl threw rocks at him and his friends from a tree, or the time his great-grandma split a tornado in two with a prayer. The chip you carry has to do with being born and raised in Oakland. A concrete chip. A slab, really. Heavy on one side. The half side. The side not white. As for your mom's side, as for your whiteness, there's too much and not enough there to know what to do with. You're from a people who took and took and took and took. And from a people taken. You were both and neither. When you took baths, you'd stare at your brown arms against your white legs in the water and wonder what they were doing together on the same body, in the same bathtub. How you ended up getting fired was related to your drinking, which was related to your skin problems, which was related to your father, which was related to history. The one story you were sure to hear from your dad, the one thing you knew for sure about what it means to be Indian, was that your people, Cheyenne people, on November 29th, 1864, were massacred at Sand Creek. He told you and your sisters that story more than any other story he could muster. Your dad was the kind of drunk who disappears weekends, lands himself in jail. He was the kind of drunk who had to stop completely, who couldn't have a drop. So you had it coming in a way. That need that won't quit. That years deep pit you were bound to dig, crawl into, struggle to get out of. Your parents maybe burned a too deep, too wide God hole through you. The hole was unfillable. Coming out of your 20s, you started to drink every night. There were many reasons for this, but you did it without a thought. Most addictions aren't premeditated. You slept better. Drinking felt good. But mostly, if there was any real reason you could pinpoint, it was because of your skin. You'd always had skin problems, since you can remember. Your dad used to rub peyote gravy on your rashes. That worked for a while, until he wasn't around anymore. The doctors wanted to call it eczema. They wanted you hooked on steroid creams. The scratching was bad because it only led to more scratching, which led to more bleeding. You'd wake up with blood underneath your fingernails, a sharp sting wherever the wound moved, because it moved everywhere, all over your body. And blood ended up on your sheets, and you'd wake up feeling like you dreamed something as important and devastating as it was forgotten. But there was no dream. There was only the open, living wound, and it itched somewhere on your body at all times. Patches and circles and fields of red and pink. Sometimes yellow, bumpy, pussy, weeping, disgusting. The surface of you. If you drank enough, you didn't scratch at night. You could deaden your body that way. You found your way in and out of a bottle. Found your limits. Lost track of them. Along the way, you figured out there was a certain amount of alcohol you could drink that could, the next day, produce a certain state of mind, which you over time began to refer to privately as the state. The state was a place you could get to wherever everything felt exactly, precisely in place, where and when it belonged. You belonged. Completely okay in it. Almost like your dad used to say, in it. Like, isn't that right? Isn't that true? But each and every bottle you bought was a medicine or a poison, depending on whether you managed to keep them full enough. The method was unstable, unsustainable. To drink enough, but not too much for a drunk, was like asking the evangelical not to say the name Jesus. And so playing drums and singing in those classes had given you something else. A way to get there without having to drink and wait and see if the next day the state might emerge from the ashes. The state was based on something you read about James Hampton years after your trip to D.C. James had given himself a title, Director of Special Projects for the State of Eternity. James was a Christian. You are not. But he was just crazy enough to make sense to you. This is what made sense. He spent 14 years building a massive piece of artwork out of junk he collected in and around the garage he rented, which was about a mile from the White House. The piece was called The Throne of the Third Heaven of the Nation's Millennium General Assembly. James made the throne for Jesus' second coming. What you get about James Hampton is his almost desperate devotion to God, to the waiting for his God to come. He made a golden throne from junk. The throne you were building was made of moments, made of experiences in the state after excess drinking, made of leftover, unused drunkenness, kept overnight, dreamed. Moon-soaked fumes you breathed into throne form, into a place you could sit. In the state, you were just unhinged enough to not get in the way. The problem came from having to drink at all. The night before you got fired, drum class had been canceled. It was the end of December, the approach of the new year. This kind of drinking was not about reaching the state. This kind of drinking was careless, pointless, one of the risks, the consequences of being the kind of drunk you are. That you'll always be, no matter how well you learn to manage it. By night's end, you'd finished a fifth of Jim Beam. A fifth is a lot if you don't work your way up to it. It can take years to drink this way, alone, on random Tuesday nights. It takes a lot from you, drinking this way. Your liver, the one doing the most living for you, detoxifying all the shit you put into your body. When you got to work the next day, you were fine. A little dizzy, still drunk. But the day felt normal enough. You went into the conference room. The powwow committee meeting was happening. You ate what they were calling breakfast enchiladas when they offered them. You met a new member of the committee. Then your supervisor, Jim, called you into his office. Called on the two-way you kept on your belt. When you got to his office, he was on the phone. He covered it with one hand. "There's a bat," he said, and pointed out to the hallway. "Get it out. We can't have bats. This is a medical facility." He said it like you'd brought the bat in yourself. Out in the hallway, you looked up and around you. You saw the thing on the ceiling in the corner near the conference room at the end of the hall. You went and got a plastic bag and a broom. You approached the bat carefully, slowly. But when you got close, it flew into the conference room. Everyone, the whole powwow committee, their heads spinning, watched as you went in there and chased it out. When you were back out in the hallway, the bat circled around you. It was behind you, and then it was on the back of your neck. It had its teeth or claws dug in. You freaked out and reached back and got the bat by a wing, and instead of doing what you should have done, put it in the trash bag you'd been carrying with you, you brought your hands together and with all your strength, everything you had in you, you squeezed. You crushed the bat in your hands, blood and thin bones and teeth in a pile in your hands. You threw it down. You would mop it up quick. Wipe clean the whole day. Start over again. But no. The whole powwow committee was there. They'd come out to watch you catch the bat after you'd chased the thing into their meeting. Every one of them looked at you with disgust. You felt it too. It was on your hands, on the floor. That creature. Back in your supervisor's office after you'd cleaned up the mess, Jim gestured for you to sit down. "I don't know what that was," Jim said. Both hands were on top of his head. "But it's not something we can tolerate in a medical facility." "The thing fucking..." "Sorry, but the thing fucking bit me. I was reacting." "And that would have been okay, Thomas. Only co-workers saw. But you smell like alcohol. And coming to work drunk... I'm sorry, but that's a fireable offense. You know we have a zero-tolerance policy here." He didn't look mad anymore. He looked disappointed. You almost told him that it was just from the night before. But that maybe wouldn't have made a difference, because you could have still blown an over-the-limit blood alcohol level. The alcohol was still in you, in your blood. "I did not drink this morning," you said. You almost crossed your heart. You'd never even done that when you were a kid. It was something about Jim. He was like a big kid. He didn't want to have to punish you. Crossing your heart seemed like a reasonable way to convince Jim you were telling him the truth. "I'm sorry," Jim said. "So that's it? I'm being fired?" "There's nothing I can do for you," Jim said. He stood up and walked out of his own office. "Go home, Thomas," he said. You get down to the train platform and enjoy the cool wind or breeze or whatever you call the rush of air the train brings before it arrives, before you even see it or its lights. When you hear it and feel that cool rush of air, you especially appreciate because of how much it cools your sweaty head. You find a seat at the front of the train. The robot voice announces the next stop by saying, or not saying exactly, but whatever it's called when robots speak, "Next stop, 12th Street Station." You remember your first powwow. Your dad took you and your sisters, after the divorce, to a Berkeley High School gym where your old family friend Paul danced over the basketball lines with that crazy light step, that grace, even though Paul was pretty big, and you'd never thought of him as graceful before. But that day you saw what a powwow was, and you saw that Paul was perfectly capable of grace and even some kind of Indian-specific cool, with footwork not unlike breakdancing, and that effortlessness that cool requires. The train moves and you think of your dad and how he took you to that powwow after the divorce, how he had never taken you before when you were younger, and you wonder if it was your mom and Christianity, the reason why you didn't go to powwows and do more Indian things. The train emerges, rises out of the underground tube in the Fruitvale district, over by that Burger King and the terrible pho place, where East 12th and International almost merge, where the graffitied apartment walls and abandoned houses, warehouses, and auto body shops appear, loom in the train window, stubbornly resist like deadweight all of Oakland's new development. Just before the Fruitvale station, you see that old brick church you always notice because of how run down and abandoned it looks. You feel a rush of sadness for your mom and her failed Christianity, for your failed family, how everyone lives in different states now, how you never see them, how you spend so much time alone. You want to cry and feel you might, but know you can't, that you shouldn't. Crying ruins you. You gave it up long ago. But the thoughts keep coming about your mom and your family at a certain time when the magical over and underworld of your Oakland-spun Christian evangelical end-of-the-world spirituality seemed to be coming to life to take you, all of you. You remember it so clearly, that time. It never moved far from you, no matter how much time had carried you away from it. Before anyone was awake, your mom was crying into her prayer book. You knew this because teardrops stain, and you remembered tear stains in her prayer book. You looked into that book more than once because you wanted to know what questions, what private conversations she might have had with God. She who spoke that mad angel language of tongues in church, she who fell to her knees, she who fell in love with your dad in Indian ceremonies she ended up calling demonic. Your train leaves the Fruitvale station, which makes you think of the Diamond District, which makes you think of Vista Street. That's where it all happened, where your family lived and died. Your older sister, Delana, was heavily into PCP, angel dust. That was when you found out you don't need religion to be slain, for the demons to come out with their tongues. One day after school, Delana smoked too much PCP. She came home and it was clear to you that she was out of her mind. You could see it in her eyes. Delana without Delana behind them. And then there was her voice. That low, deep, guttural sound. She yelled at your dad and he yelled back and she told him to shut up and he did shut up because of that voice. She told him that he didn't even know which god he was worshipping. And soon after that, Delana was on the floor of your sister Christine's room, foaming at the mouth. Your mom called an emergency prayer circle and they prayed over her and she foamed and writhed and eventually stopped when that part of the high wore off. The drug dimmed. Her eyes closed. The thing was done with her. When she woke up, they gave her a glass of milk. And when she was back with her normal voice and eyes, she didn't remember any of it. Later, you remember your mom saying to take drugs was like sneaking into the kingdom of heaven under the gates. It seemed to you more like the kingdom of hell. But maybe the kingdom is bigger and more terrifying than we could ever know. Maybe we've all been speaking the broken tongue of angels and demons too long to know that that's what we are, who we are, what we're speaking. Maybe we don't ever die but change. Always in the state, without hardly ever even knowing that we're in it. When you get off at the Coliseum station, you walk over the pedestrian bridge with butterflies in your stomach. You do and don't want to be there. You want to drum, but also to be heard drumming. Not as yourself, but just as the drum. The big drum sound made to make the dancers dance. You don't want to be seen by anyone from work. The shame of your drinking and showing up to work with the smell still on you was too much. Getting attacked by the bat and crushing it in front of them was part of it, too. You go through the metal detector at the front, and your belt gets you another go-through. You get the beep the second time because of change in your pocket. The security guard is an older black guy who doesn't seem to care much about anything but avoiding the beeping of the detector. "Take it out. Anything. Anything in your pockets. Take it out," he says. "That's all I got," you say. But when you walk through, it beeps again. "You ever have surgery?" the guy asks you. "What?" "I don't know. Maybe you have a metal plate in your head, or..." "Nah, man, I got nothing metal on me." "Well, I gotta pat you down now," the guy says, like it's your fault. "All right," you say, and put your arms up. After he pats you down, he gestures for you to walk through again. This time when it beeps, he just waves you through. About 10 feet away, you're looking down as you walk and you realize what it was. Your boots. Steel toe. You started wearing them when you got the job. Jim recommended it. You almost go back to tell the guy. But it doesn't matter anymore. You find Bobby Big Medicine under a canopy. He nods up. then tilts his head toward an open seat around the drum. There's no small talk. "Grand entry song," Bobby says to you because he knows everyone else knows. You pick up your drumstick and wait for the others. You hear the sound, but not the words the powwow MC is saying, and you watch for Bobby's stick to go up. When it does, your heart feels like it stops. You wait for the first hit. You pray a prayer in your head to no one in particular about nothing in particular. You clear a way for a prayer by thinking nothing. Your prayer will be the hit and the song and the keeping of time. Your prayer will begin and end with the song. Your heart starts to hurt from lack of breath when you see his drumstick go up, and you know they're coming, the dancers, and it's time. Part 4. Powwow. A man must dream a long time in order to act with grandeur, and dreaming is nursed in darkness. Jean Genet.
Orville Redfeather. Inside the Colosseum, the field is already packed with people, with dancers, tables, and canopies, packed to the stands. Camping chairs and lawn chairs are scattered across the field, with and without people sitting in them, saved spots. On top of the tables and hung on the backs and sides of canopy walls are powwow hats and t-shirts with slogans like "Native Pride" written in capital block letters, gripped by eagle talons. There are dream catchers, flutes, tomahawks, and bows and arrows. Indian jewelry of every kind is splayed and hung everywhere. Crazy amounts of turquoise and silver. Orville and his brothers stop for a minute at the table with beaded A's and Raiders beanies. But they really want to check out the line of food tables in the outfield. They spend their fountain money and go up to the second deck to eat. The fry bread is wide and the meat and grease are deep. "Man, that's goot," Orville says. "Psh," Luther says. "Quit trying to talk Indian." "Shut up. What am I supposed to sound like, a white boy?" Orville says. "Sometimes you sound like you want to be Mexican," Lonnie says. "Like when we're at school." "Shut up," Orville says. Luther elbows Lonnie, and they both crack up at Orville. Orville takes off his hat and hits them both on the back of the head with it. Then Orville takes the taco and steps over the row to sit behind them. After sitting in silence for a while, he hands the taco to Lonnie. "How much you say you could win if you win?" Luther asks Orville. "I don't want to talk about it. It's bad luck," Orville says. "Yeah, but you said it was like 5,000, Luther says. "I said I don't want to talk about it," Orville says. "'Cause you think it'll jinx it, huh?" "Luther, shut the fuck up." "All right," Luther says. "All right, then," Orville says. "But imagine how much cool shit we could get with that kind of money," Luther says. "Yeah," Lonnie says. "We could get a PS4, a big TV, some J's. We would give it all to Grandma," Orville says. "Oh, man, that's weak," Luther says. "Come on, you know she likes to work," Lonnie says, still chewing the last of the taco. "There's probably other stuff she'd rather do if she could," Orville says. "Yeah, but we could just keep some of it," Luther says. "Shit," Orville says, looking down at the time on his phone. "I gotta get down to the locker room." "What do you want us to do?" Luther says. "Stay up here," Orville says. "I'll come get you after." "What? Come on," Lonnie says. "I'll come get you after. It won't take that long," Orville says. "But we can't barely see shit from here," Luther says. "Yeah," Lonnie says. Orville walks away. He knows the more he argues, the more rebellious they'll get. The men's locker room is loud with laughter. At first, Orville thinks they're laughing at him, but then realizes someone had told a joke just before he got in, because more jokes come as he sits down. Mostly it's older guys, but there are a few young men in there too. He puts his regalia on slow, carefully, and puts his earphones in, but before he can put a song on, he sees a guy across from him gesturing for him to take them out. It's this huge Indian guy. He stands up, he's in full regalia, and he picks his feet up one at a time, which makes his feathers shake, which sort of scares Orville. The guy clears his throat. "Now you young men in here, listen up. Don't get too excited out there. That dance is your prayer. So don't rush it, and don't dance how you practice. There's only one way for an Indian man to express himself. It's that dance that comes from all the way back there. All the way over there. You learn that dance to keep it, to use it. Whatever you got going on in your life, you don't leave it all in here, like them players do when they go out on that field. You bring it with you. You dance it. Any other way you try to say what you really mean, it's just gonna make you cry. Don't act like you don't cry. That's what we do. Indian men. We're crybabies. You know it. But not out there, he says and points to the door of the locker room. A couple of the older guys make this low, huh, sound. Then another couple of guys say, aho, in unison. Orville looks around the room and he sees all these men dressed up like him. They all needed to dress up to look Indian too. There's something like the shaking of feathers he felt somewhere between his heart and his stomach. He knows what the guy said is true. To cry is to waste the feeling. He needs to dance with it. Crying is for when there's nothing else left to do. This is a good day. This is a good feeling. Something he needs, to dance the way he needs to dance to win the prize. But no, not the money. To dance for the first time like he learned. From the screen, but also from practice. From the dancing came the dancing. There are hundreds of dancers in front of him, behind him, to his left and right. He's surrounded by the variegation of color and pattern specific to Indianness, gradients from one color to the next, geometrically sequenced sequined shapes on shiny and leathered fabrics, the quill, bead, ribbon, plume, feathers from magpies, hawks, crows, eagles. There are crowns and gourds, and bells and drumsticks, metal cones, sticked and arrowed flickers, shag anklets, and hairpipe bandoliers, barrettes and bracelets, and bustles that fan out in perfect circles. He watches people point out each other's regalia. He is an old station wagon at a car show. He is a fraud. He tries to shake off the feeling of feeling like a fraud. He can't allow himself to feel like a fraud because then he'll probably act like one. To get to that feeling, to get to that prayer, you have to trick yourself out of thinking altogether, out of acting, out of everything. To dance as if time only mattered insofar as you could keep a beat to it, in order to dance in such a way that time itself discontinued, disappeared, ran out, or into the feeling of nothingness under your feet when you jumped, when you dipped your shoulders like you were trying to dodge the very air you were suspended in, your feathers a flutter of echoes centuries old, your whole being a kind of flight. To perform and win, you have to dance true. But this is just grand entry. No judges. Orville hops a little and dips his arms. He puts his arms out and tries to keep light on his feet. When he starts to feel embarrassed, he closes his eyes. He tells himself not to think. He thinks the thought, don't think, over and over. He opens his eyes and sees everyone around him. They're all feathers in movement. They're all one dance. When grand entry is over, the dancers disperse, moving out in every direction in a ripple of chatter and bells, headed for the vendors or to find family or to walk around, giving and accepting compliments, acting normal, like they don't look like what they look like. Indians dressed up as Indians. Orville's stomach rumbles and shudders. He looks up to see if he can find his brothers.
Tony Loneman. To get to the powwow, Tony Loneman catches a train. He gets dressed at home and wears his regalia all the way there. He's used to being stared at, but this is different. He wants to laugh at them staring at him. It's his joke to himself about them. Everyone has been staring at him his whole life. Never for any other reason than the drome. Never for any other reason than that his face told you something bad happened to him. A car wreck you should, but can't look away from. No one on the train knows about the powwow. Tony's just an Indian dressed like an Indian on the train for no apparent reason. But people love to see the pretty history. Tony's regalia is blue, red, orange, yellow, and black, the colors of a fire at night. Another image people love to think about, Indians around a fire. But this isn't that. Tony is the fire and the dance and the night. He's standing in front of a BART map. An older white woman sitting across from him points to the map and asks him where to get off if she's going to the airport. She knows the answer to this question. She would have already looked it up on her phone numerous times to be sure. She wants to see if the Indian speaks. It's the next question she means to get to. The face behind the face she makes says it all. Tony doesn't answer about the airport right away. He stares at her and waits for what she'll say next. So you're a Native American? We get off at the same exit, Tony says. Coliseum. There's a powwow. You should come. Tony walks to the door to look out the window. I would, but... Tony hears that she's responding, but he doesn't listen. People don't want any more than a little story they can bring back home with them, to tell their friends and family around the dinner table, to talk about how they saw a real Native American boy on a train, that they still exist. Tony looks down and watches the tracks fly by. He feels the train pull him back as it slows. He grips the metal handle, shifts his weight to the left, then rocks back to his right when the train comes to a complete stop. The woman behind him is saying something, but it can't matter what. He steps off the train, and when he gets to the stairs, he takes off, skipping two steps the whole way down.
Blue. Blue is driving to pick up Edwin. It's that weird night-morning color, that deep blue-orange-white. The day she's been anticipating for almost a year is just starting. It feels good to be back in Oakland. All the way back. She's been back a year. On a regular paycheck now, in her own studio apartment, with her own car again for the first time in 5 years. Blue tilts the rear view down and looks at herself. She sees a version of herself she thought was long gone. Someone she'd left behind, ditched for her real Indian life on the res. Crystal. From Oakland. She's not gone. She's somewhere behind Blue's eyes in the rear view. Blue's favorite place to smoke a cigarette is in the car. She likes how the smoke escapes when all the windows are down. She lights one. She tries to at least say a little prayer every time she smokes. It makes her feel less guilty for smoking. She takes in a deep drag and holds it. She says, "Thank you," as she blows out the smoke. She'd gone all that way to Oklahoma to find out where she came from, and all she'd gotten for it was a color for a name. No one had heard of any Red Feather family. She'd asked around plenty. She wonders if maybe her birth mom made it up. Maybe she didn't know her own tribe either. Maybe she had been adopted too. Maybe Blue would end up having to make up her own name and tribe too. Pass that on to her possible children. Blue throws her cigarette out the window as she passes the Grand Lake Theater. The theater meant many things to her over the years. Right now, she's thinking of the awkward, clearly stated non-date date she recently went on with Edwin. Edwin's her intern, her assistant for the powwow event coordination for this past year. The movie was sold out, so they walked around the lake instead. The awkward silence that was the entire walk was intense. They both kept starting sentences and stopping them short, then saying, "Never mind." She liked Edwin. She likes him. There's something about him that feels like family. Maybe because he has a similar background. In Edwin's case, he hadn't known his dad, who is Native, who happens to be the MC at the powwow. So they had that in common, sort of, but not much else. She definitely does not like Edwin as anything more than a coworker and possible future friend. She'd told him 1,000 times with her eyes that there's no way. In what her eyes didn't do, in how they looked away when his tried to stay. When Blue pulls up to his house, she calls him from her car. He doesn't answer. She walks up and knocks on his door. She should have texted that she was outside the minute she left her house. The drive to West Oakland took about 15 minutes without traffic. Why didn't she make him take BART? Right, it's too early. But the bus? No, he had a bad experience on the bus he won't even tell her about. Does she baby him? Poor Edwin. He really does try. He really doesn't know how he comes off to other people. He's so painfully aware of his physical size, and he makes too many comments about himself, his weight. It makes people as uncomfortable as he appears to be most of the time. Blue knocks again, hard, to the point that it would have been rude, except that Edwin was making her wait outside his door on this day they'd both been planning and working hard toward for so many months. Blue looks at her phone for the time, then checks her email and texts. When nothing of interest comes up, she checks her Facebook. It's a tired feed she'd read last night before going to bed. No new activity. Old comments and posts she'd already seen. She presses the home button and for a second, just for a small moment, thinks she should open her other Facebook feed. On that other Facebook, she'd find the information and media she'd always been looking for. On that other Facebook feed, she'd find true connection. That is where she'd always wanted to be, is what she'd always hoped Facebook would turn out to be. But there is nothing else to check. There is no other Facebook. So she clicks the screen off and puts the phone back in her pocket. Just as she's about to knock again, Edwin's big face appears before her. He's holding 2 mugs. Coffee? He says.
Dean Oxendine. Dean is in a makeshift storytelling booth he built to record stories. He aims the camera at his face and presses record. He doesn't smile or speak. He's recording his face as if the image, the pattern of light and dark arranged there, might mean something on the other side of that lens. He's using the camera his uncle gave to him before he died, the Bolex. One of Dean's favorite directors, Darren Aronofsky, used the Bolex in his movies Pi and Requiem for a Dream, which Dean would say is one of his favorite movies, though it's hard to call such a fucked up movie a favorite. But that for Dean is what is so good about the movie. Aesthetically, it's rich, so you enjoy the experience. But you don't exactly come away from the film glad that you watched it. And yet you wouldn't have it any other way. Dean believes this kind of realness is something his uncle would have appreciated. This unflinching stare into the void of addiction and depravity. This is the kind of thing only a camera can keep its eye wide open for. Dean turns the camera off and sets it up on a tripod to point at the stool he has placed in the corner for the storytellers. He flips one switch on his cheap lighting gear for soft light behind the stool, then the other switch for the harder lighting he has behind him. He'll ask everyone who comes into his booth why they've come to the powwow, what powwows mean to them, where do they live, what does being Indian mean to them. He doesn't need more stories for his project. He doesn't even need to show a product at the end of the year for the grant money he's received. This is about the powwow, the committee. It's about documentation, for posterity. It might end up in his final production, whatever that might be. He still doesn't know. He's still letting the content direct the vision, which is not just another way of saying he's making it up as he goes along. Dean walks through the black curtains out into the powwow.
Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield. Opal is sitting alone in Plaza Infield, second deck. She's watching from up there, so as to not be seen by her grandsons. By Orville, especially. It would mess with him if he saw her there. She hasn't been to an A's game in years. Why did they stop going to games? Time only seems to have skipped, or to have sped by without you when you looked the other way. That's what Opal had been doing, closing her eyes and ears to the closing of her eyes and ears. Lonnie was just starting to walk on his own the last time they were here. Opal is listening to the drum. She hasn't heard a big drum like that since she was young. She scans the field for the boys. It's a blur. She should probably get glasses. Probably should have gotten glasses a long time ago. She would never tell anyone this, but she enjoys the distance being a blur. She can't tell how crowded it is, certainly not the same crowd as at a baseball game. She looks up at the sky, then at the empty third deck. That's where they'd watched the game from with the boys. She sees something fly over the edge of the rim of the Colosseum. Not a bird. Its movement is unnatural. She squints to try to see it better.
Edwin Black. Edwin hands Blue a coffee he made for her just minutes before she came and knocked at his door. French-pressed organic dark roast. He'd guessed a moderate dose of sugar and milk. He doesn't smile or make small talk as they walk to her car together. Today means everything for them. The countless hours they put in, all the different drum groups and vendors and dancers they had to call and convince to come, that there was prize money to be had, money to be made. Edwin's made more phone calls this year than he has in his whole life. People didn't really want to sign on for a new powwow, especially one in Oakland. If it doesn't go well, the powwow won't happen again next year, and they'll be out of a job. But this means more than a job for Edwin at this point. This is a new life. Plus, his dad will be there today. It's almost too much to think about. Or maybe Edwin just drank too much coffee this morning. The drive to the Coliseum feels slow and tense. Every time he thinks to say something, he takes a sip of coffee instead. This is only the second time they're spending time together outside of work. She has NPR on so low it's unintelligible. "I started writing a story the other day," Edwin says. "Oh yeah?" Blue says. "It's about a native guy. I'll call him Victor." "Victor? Really?" Blue says with comically half-closed eyelids. "Fine, his name is Phil. You want to hear it?" "Sure." "Okay, so Phil lives in a nice apartment in downtown Oakland he got grandfathered into. It's a big place with fixed rent. Phil works at Whole Foods. One day a white guy he works with, I'll call him John, he asks Phil if he wants to hang out after work. They hang out, go to a bar, have a good time. Then John ends up spending the night at Phil's. The next day, when Phil comes home from work, John's still there. Only he has a couple of friends over. They brought a bunch of their stuff, too. Phil asks John what's going on, and John tells Phil he figured since there's so much extra room that Phil wasn't using, that it would be okay. Phil doesn't like it, but he's not one for confrontation, so he lets it go. Over the next few weeks, and then months, the house fills up with squatters, hipsters, corporate tech nerds, and every kind of young white person imaginable. They're either living in Phil's apartment or just sort of hanging out indefinitely. Phil doesn't understand how he let it get so out of control. Then, just when he gets up the nerve to say something, to kick everyone out, he gets really sick. Someone had stolen his blanket, and when he asked John about it, John gave him a new blanket. Phil believes that blanket made him sick. He's in bed for a week. By the time he comes out, things have changed. Progressed, you might say. Some of the rooms have been turned into offices. John's running some kind of startup out of Phil's apartment. Phil tells John he has to go. Everyone has to leave. And that Phil had never agreed to any of this. That's when John provides some paperwork. Phil had signed something, apparently. maybe in a fever dream. But John won't show him the papers. "Trust me, bro," John says. "You don't want to go there. Oh, and by the way, you know that spot under the stairs?" John says. "Spot?" Phil says. "That room." He means the closet under the stairs. Phil knows what's coming next. "Let me guess. You're moving me to that spot under the stairs. That's my new room," Phil says. "You guessed it," John says. "This is my apartment. My grandfather lived here. He passed it on to me to take care of," Phil says. "It's for my family, if anyone needs a place to stay. That's what it's supposed to be here for." And here John produces a gun. He points it at Phil's face, then proceeds to walk Phil to the closet under the stairs. "Told you, bro," John says. "Told me what?" Phil says. "You should have just joined the company. We could have used someone like you," John says. "You never asked me anything. You just came to my apartment and stayed here, then took over," Phil says. "Whatever, bro. My record keepers have it going down differently," John says, and nods with his head at a couple of guys on a couch in the downstairs living room, furiously typing on their Apple computers, what Phil assumes is a different version of the events happening just then. Suddenly feeling very tired and hungry, Phil retreats to his under-the-stairs closet room. "That's it. That's what I have so far." "That's funny," Blue says, like she doesn't think it's funny, but feels like that's what he wants her to say. "It's stupid. Sounded a lot better in my head," Edwin says. "So much is like that, right?" Blue says. "I feel like something like that actually happened to a friend of mine. I mean, not exactly like that, but like a warehouse in West Oakland she inherited from her uncle got taken over by squatters."
"Really?"
"That's their culture," Blue says.
"What is?"
"Taking over." "I don't know. My mom's white." "You don't have to defend all white people you think aren't a part of the problem just because I said something negative about white culture," Blue says. And Edwin's heart rate goes up. He'd heard her get mad on the phone, at other people, but never at him.
"Sorry," Edwin says.
"Don't apologize," Blue says.
"Sorry."
Edwin and Blue set up the tables and canopies together in the early morning light. They unpack folding tables and chairs. When everything is set, Blue looks at Edwin.
"Should we just leave the safe in the car until later?" she says.
It's a small safe they got from Walmart. It wasn't easy to convince the grantees to cut them a check they could cash. Cash was a problem when it came to grants and how nonprofits managed their money. But after the phone calls and emails, all the explanations and testimony about the people who come to powwows to compete, people who want to win cash because they prefer cash, sometimes don't have bank accounts, and don't want to lose the 3% cash checking service take, they finally agreed on Visa gift cards. A whole mess of them. "There's no reason not to get it now," Edwin says. "I'm sure it'll get crazy later and we won't want to go all the way out to the parking lot when it's time to hand out the prizes."
"True," Blue says.
They pull the safe out of her trunk, then walk with it together. Not because it's so heavy, but because it's so wide.
"I've never held this much money," Blue says.
"I know it's not that heavy, but it feels super heavy, right?" Edwin says.
"Maybe we should have gotten money orders," Blue says.
"But we advertise cash. That's one of the ways to draw people. You said that."
"I guess."
"No, but I mean, you said that. It was your idea."
"It just seems a little flashy," Blue says as they approach the table.
"Powwows are all about flash, aren't they?"
Calvin Johnson. They're almost done with their breakfast before anyone says anything. They're at the Denny's next to the Coliseum. Calvin got eggs over easy with sausage and toast. Charles and Carlos both got the Grand Slam, and Octavio ordered oatmeal, but he's mostly just been drinking coffee. Shit had gotten more serious as the day drew closer, and as it got more serious, they all got quiet about it. But Calvin is more worried about making sure they steal the money sooner than later. He's more worried about getting away with it than getting the money. He's still pissed at Charles for involving him in this shit plan. that Charles had smoked up all his shit, that that's why they're here. He couldn't get over it, but he couldn't get out of it either. Calvin cleans up his yolk with toast, washes it down with the last of his orange juice. It's sour, sweet, salty, and that thick, specifically yolk flavor.